Memories and Premonitions of the Survivor.
It's a novel about the way memory transports us, not only to the past, but also strangely to the future, that a deep memory can be almost prescient of something is to come, that feeling we have sometimes of deja vu. So it mimics those kinds of sensations, which again is about the psyche of the survivor as much more than the experience that the survivor survived.
That's Peter Filkins, translator of the work of H.G. Adler, talking about the third novel in Adler's trilogy about the Holocaust, The Wall. Later, we replay a long excerpt from a previous interview with Filkins about his translation of the first novel in the trilogy, The Journey. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station or on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. German-Jewish writer H.G. Adler survived the Nazi concentration camps, but lost his first wife and other members of his family in the Holocaust. While in the camps, he managed to make extensive notes that became a scholarly treatise on the experience of internees in Theresienstadt, one of the camps he was in. But after the war, Adler also wrote a trilogy of novels exploring both that experience and what it was like to be a survivor of the Holocaust. Those novels are The Journey, Panorama, and now recently published in English, The Wall. Adler's been compared to such writers as Kafka, Joyce, and Robert Musil. My guest Peter Filkins' masterful translation of The Wall exposes the reader to the profound questions faced by survivors of such extreme trauma. How to go on living when so many others have died? How to communicate that trauma to those who have not experienced it? And can one use art to convey the experience of being the victim of ultimate evil? Peter Filkins is a poet and translator of German literature. He was the first to translate H.G. Adler's novels into English. His translation of The Wall was named one of the best books of the year by Publishers Weekly. He teaches literature and writing at Bard College at Simon's Rock in Massachusetts.
Well, Peter Filkins, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's lovely to be here again.
This book, H.G. Adler's The Wall, you write it marks the completion of the Shoah trilogy that began with the writing of Panorama in 1948, and continued with the composition of The Journey in 1950-51. We've spoken to you about those works. What do you mean by a Shoah trilogy?
Well, Adler himself didn't call it a trilogy. He didn't name it as that. But it's obviously a trilogy in that the three books account for the lead-up to the immersion within and the survival of the Shoah. Panorama starts after World War I, follows the protagonist right up to the camps and he's in a camp. The journey really begins with the deportation of a family, and then they end up in a place very much like Auschwitz. And then The Wall begins post-war with Arthur Landau, who has lost his first wife to the camps, as did Adler, who leaves a city much like Prague, as did Adler, and who ends up in exile in London, where Adler lived as well.
The characters are not the same, however.
Correct. And that would, you could argue in some ways, would argue against being a technical trilogy in that sense. So it's not the three books do not make a continuous saga. Yet the consciousness is the same. And the consciousness behind the three novels is H.G. Adler. And I would say that it's a Shoah trilogy because it is Adler thinking through his experience and thinking through how to think about his experience. And that experience was, of course, tied to the Shoah or the Holocaust.
So tell us more about H.G. Adler and the circumstances that are reflected within the book.
Quickly, he's born in 1910. At the age of 32, he and his first wife, Gertrude Klepetar, are deported to Theresienstadt, where he spends 2.5 years. Then he and she and her mother go to Auschwitz. Her mother is selected out. She chooses to follow her mother to the gas chamber. He is not selected out. goes on to two other camps and survives the war, comes back to Prague. And when in Prague, he writes to a woman he had known before the war. He takes him a while to find her address. And she's in South Wales. She survived the war in South Wales. Bettina Gross was her name. And at the very same time that he finds her address, she finds his. And their letters to each other after the war cross in the mail. They begin corresponding. After 6 months, he proposes marriage to her in a letter without having seen her in 7 years. She accepts. And this allows him to get a visa to go to England in 1947. And it's a 6-week visa, but they immediately marry upon him landing in London. And that allows him to stay on. So as with Wall, Arthur Landau is in London with his second wife, Joanna, and their two children, Michael and Ava. The difference being that H.G. Adler and Bettina had one child, a son. So you have these slight differences in autobiographical facts, which shows that Adler is using his biography, but also shaping it to a particular fictional end. So it comes out of his life, but he shapes that life at the same time.
Now, The Wall is very much a novel of survivor's guilt. You refer to it as the seeming injustice of his own survival. Talk a little bit about how survivor's guilt informs this novel.
He, at a critical point, Arthur says, Joanna and he are talking about his experience. And she, you know, she says, clearly you remember the experience of being in the camps. And he says, yes, and it's important to me. But he says, I cannot fully remember the experience because I didn't die. In order to completely remember and to completely identify with the victims, he would have had to die. And this becomes a paradox in his life. He cannot entirely go back and process the experience, to use a more contemporary term, because to do that would have meant to have died like the other victims. On the other hand, he cannot stop trying to pay homage to those victims and pay homage to that experience. So he's possessed by it and by the past, but also by the need to move into the future, to find a viable means to move into the future. Two things allow him to do that, as it was true for Adler himself. One, Arthur's scholarship. He's writing a book on the sociology of the oppressed while he's in the metropolis, which is clearly London. And this is the first thing that Adler did on leaving the camps. Two is the love of Joanna in the novel for Arthur, as Bettina's love for H.G. Adler was really what kept him alive in the early 50s.
Mm. In this sociology of oppressed people, it puts one in mind of the scholarly work that Adler himself was famous for. Talk a little bit about that. And are there connections between the two?
Yeah, most certainly so. Adler, when he's in Theresienstadt, collects numerous documents about the camp, about the ghetto, really, and goes back after the war and picks up a briefcase that he had left with Leo Beck, who was the head of German Jewry at the time, and picks up this briefcase and walks out really with the next 40 years of his life, because it has all of the documents on Theresienstadt and also has stories and a novel he was writing, the first draft of the Theresienstadt book, which he actually worked on there. And then he sits right down to work on the Theresienstadt book immediately after the war, as well as sitting right down to begin Panorama, The Journey, and then eventually The Wall. He finishes The Wall in 1956. The Theresienstadt book was published in 1955. So he's doing these in parallel fashion, serious scholarship, not just writing essays, but serious research. It's a 1,000-page monograph on Theresienstadt, one of the first Holocaust studies that we have, at the same time that he writes 6 novels over the same decade, which is probably the most unique and extraordinary thing about Adler, that he was able to maintain both of these fields of inquiry. He also said when he got to Theresienstadt, when he entered it, that if he survived it, he would record it in scholarly fashion and in artistic fashion. And that is exactly what he did.
Now, his character, Arthur, in the book, who's writing this scholarly work, is not making a whole lot of headway in getting it supported or recognized. Is that also what happened to Adler?
Very much so. He basically finishes the first draft of the Tredjestad book by 1948 and then starts in on Panorama while revising the Tredjestad book. But he could find no publisher. It took him 7 years. He had connection with Hermann Broch, the very esteemed German writer, who tried to help him to find a publisher, even to publish it in English first, perhaps. That didn't work out. He turned to Theodor Adorno for help, and Adorno did eventually, interestingly enough, arrange for the subsidy that allowed for the book to be published when it was accepted by C.H. Beck Publishers. But it took him a very long time to find audience for it. You have to remember, no one was ready to hear about the camps at this stage. No one in Germany, everyone was trying to move on to the post-war economic miracle. It takes until the early 60s for people to really begin to be interested in what was going on. Adler presses through. When it is published, it gets quite a lot of attention. It wins a major prize, and he begins to be asked to do lectures on his experience and on Tredjestad and the camps themselves. So for a brief while, he had a fair amount of renown as a scholar. However, he wanted to be known as a novelist, and at the same time, he's writing his novels and can't find publishers for them. He finishes The Wall in 1956, but it's not published until 1989, the year after his death, and he never knew it was going to be published. It was not even as if it were in galleys and he died. It was actually arranged for publication after he died by people who believed in his work.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Peter Filkins. He is the translator of H.G. Adler's The Wall. It's the third in a series of three novels that have the Holocaust at its center. So his book, The Wall, is very much about memory. He moves back and forth in time. He uses this literary device, moving back and forth constantly in time, so much so that you actually have a guide at the end of the book to the actual events that happen so that the reader can kind of keep them straight. Talk about his use of the fluidity of time and its connection to memory in this book.
Well, I think it's a novel in which Arthur is constantly falling asleep and constantly waking up. And when he falls asleep, it transports him from one reality to another, be it the Prague reality back to London, or London back to Prague, or back to the camps, or back to remembering Franziska, who is Arthur's first wife, or rather nightmarish scenes where he imagines being carted off to a crematorium, and at the end of the novel, a kind of sardonic comic scene of a sociologist conference, which is a circus in the middle of a park. So it moves through fantasy, it moves through reverie, it moves through memory, it moves through the quotidian. There's long scenes at a cocktail party with post-war exiled intellectuals. So it's a novel about the way memory transports us, not only to the past, but also strangely to the future, that a deep memory can be almost prescient of, or the way that a dream can be prescient of what something is to come. That feeling we have sometimes of deja vu, I've been in this place, and yet you know you haven't. And so it mimics those kinds of sensations, which again is about the psyche of the survivor as much more than the experience that the survivor survived. Adler is much more interested in how the mind processes these kinds of experiences. There isn't actually very much about the camps in the novel. Mm-hmm. There's hardly any mention of Arthur's direct experience in whatever kind of camp that he was in. It's really about how he is thinking about the past in the present, which is as much of the past as he can maintain.
And he gets a job right after the war, this character gets a job in Prague, I assume, at a museum that holds artifacts of those who have been murdered in the Holocaust. This is a very interesting kind of construct to have happen, and it gives the author an opportunity to encounter different ways that people have of dealing with memory. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's very interesting is in the early 50s, in 1956, when he's finishing the novel, H.G. Adler is posing the problem of the museum decades before it's even being discussed in critical theory or art history. That the problem being, how does the museum preserve artifacts? And particularly, how does a museum preserve artifacts that are tied to human beings, be they anthropological artifacts, cultural artifacts? Obviously, this becomes very serious in terms of the Holocaust. Arthur works in a museum, which is where portraits of the deceased or their ancestors have been deposited, and where huge piles of prayer books have been and prayer shawls have been deposited. And he sees these objects as patients. He refers to them as patients, and one of his colleagues gets very irate about this. She sees them simply as objects which belong to the state. And of course, this is soon to become a communist totalitarian state in itself in Czechoslovakia. So the problem is, how do you pay honor to these objects and remember that they're tied to human beings? This, of course, has become a very vexed question in the Holocaust, in Holocaust studies. How do you put together a memorial? We even have this in our own culture, things like the 9/11 memorial. How do you properly remember people who have passed under very tragic circumstances and yet not codify or turn into a commodity the memory of those people?
It's about appropriation and ownership in some way.
Very much. You know, of course, Adler himself is in that pickle as a novelist. How does he write a novel about the people while he himself has survived, going back again to Arthur's notion that he cannot be them because he did not die. There is a separation between him and the victims. So it's a fine line to walk. And I think the novel is as much about walking that fine line as it is about trying to resolve it. Well, I don't think it does resolve it. I don't think it would be proper to resolve.
Well, there's even a controversy about whether art is appropriate to talk about the Holocaust with.
Yes, though Adler felt very strongly about this. And of course, there's the famous quote, often misunderstood, I think, but Adorno's quote that you can't write poetry after Auschwitz, which is a more complicated subject than that quote alone bears witness to. But they actually corresponded about this subject matter, and Adler said, no, you must. You need every tool in the bag to come at this experience. When he's in Theresienstadt, he writes 130 poems in rhyming quatrains while he's there. And as we've talked already, he's writing six novels at the same time. He's writing a 1,000-page monograph on Theresienstadt. He refused to separate the two and felt that without art, you couldn't render this experience. It's also a very interesting stage we're at now, where we are really looking at a time where very shortly we will have no living survivors. And it will be art, then, that is our only means of imagining our way back into this experience and trying again to pay homage to it.
It's either art or forgetting in a very profound human sense.
Yes. And, you know, and as I think also Adler anticipates, we realize that even scholarship is a form of art, that memoir is a form of art, that language itself is obviously artifice, and that we are creatures of artifice, creatures of culture and artifice. And to think we can turn away from them and arrive at a neat and tidy objective reality is simply untrue. And Adler saw this very, very early on and again tried to follow these parallel avenues of scholarship and art in combination with one another.
We're talking with Peter Filkins. He's the translator of the just published in English novel by H.G. Adler, The Wall. Now, The Wall, we haven't yet really talked about The Wall and its symbology. Tell us what this title is referring to in this book. This is a central symbol that runs throughout the book.
Yeah, the novel opens with Arthur in West Park Row in the metropolis, which is London. And he looks out the window and he sees a wall wherever he goes. It's not a wall in the sense of the wall of a building or of an apartment, but it's a metaphor. And it's a wall that he cannot penetrate or jump over or get around. And it's the past. It is the barrier between him and the past. And yet, wherever he goes, it's there. So it also becomes a part of him. Joanna even says at one point, it's not all bad, that there's a certain kind of grace in having this to carry around inside you. And that seems, you know, almost a troubling statement, given that it's associated with the loss of Arthur's first wife. But what she means for Arthur is that it's who he is. By confronting the wall, he confronts himself in its most raw and paradoxical and troubled state. And that is who he is. He's a bundle of anxiety in many ways. And that links back to the shifting to the past and to the future and to memory and the present. And it's a kind of anxiety that keeps shifting him between those realms. And the wall is the mediator between those realms. He doesn't continually focus on that through the novel. He establishes it as a kind of symbolic reference point that comes up now and then.
It's also, it seems, not just a wall between the present and the past, but also between himself and home. I mean, he's an exile, so he's neither fish nor fowl, and he can't go back to where he came from.
Yes. Adler faces two of the great cataclysms of the 20th century, and that is deportation and permanent exile. Obviously, the story of the Shoah, the Holocaust, is at the core of the 20th century. You can't get around it. And then the state of permanent exile, which we forget, either in the Cold War or how many people were displaced after the war and couldn't go back, either because of politics and political barriers, or simply couldn't bear to live in Germany again, despite identifying deeply with its culture, its history, its language. Arthur can't go back. He decides to leave, and as for Adler himself, there was a communist putsch in 1948, and he never returned to Prague again. He did go back to Germany to do research on a fairly regular basis, and he was not one to boycott Germany or refuse its language. But yes, he's in a state of exile. There's a wall between himself and his past, which is geographic, which is psychological, which is political, which is cultural and historical as well.
His wife, Johanna, has a different perspective on being a survivor than he does.
Well, as did Bettina, because Johanna left before the war and lost, in the novel, loses her two brothers and her parents. Bettina leaves before the war starts in 1938, and her mother is actually with Adler in Theresienstadt and is on the same transport as Adler and Gertrude and her mother to Auschwitz, and that's where Bettina's mother perishes. So it's the story of the survivor who survives without being directly in the experience, and the survivor who survives and can't forget that experience. And this was a unique marriage for Adler and his wife Bettina. There's even been talk of, they have an elaborate correspondence, particularly right after the war. And in Germany, I know of a scholar who's working on publishing their correspondence because of this aspect. It is so rare that you have the survivor who survives outside the experience and the survivor who survives in the experience in such intimate relation and discussion with one another.
And yet, because her perspective is that, she is able to provide a lifeline to Arthur.
Yes. I mean, she reminds him that part of their duty is to make a new beginning. And the way to pay honor to those who have died is, in one way, to live. Arthur can't die in the way that they died. So the only option is for him to live, and to live in some grounded, purposeful manner. And of course, one is his work, and then two is his raising a family, his children, and trying to find footing in the world around him. He struggles to do that because everybody keeps telling him, go get a job, and you know, you need to support your family, and he's just not interested in that. He's only interested in doing serious writing and serious thinking and serious academic work. So he needs to live, and Joanna is the one who reminds him that he can, that there's a way to do that.
I wonder if you could read this section from the book in which he talks about surviving, and I think it beautifully expresses how his remembrance of the past is what gives him meaning in this life.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that this takes place in the section in the Art History Museum. And he's had an argument with his colleague about what these objects are or these patients are and the portraits and how to pay honor to them. And his real feeling about it is the statement when he says, "We are remnant survivors who are there for all who are not. That's true in general. The living are there for the dead, for their predecessors, and thus we also represent the history of the dead. How difficult it is, then, to exist as oneself when we are also history, so much history. But we are particularly there for all those dragged away by force and annihilated. You know what I mean, those of whom not a trace. We are the history of the exterminated, the history of the shadow that consumed them, and we collect what was stolen from them, what we can store up of their remains. But that is indeed alive, and really not history. It amounts to neither memory nor keepsakes. It is commemoration."
It's beautiful. There's also another device, I guess you'd say, or theme in the book, in which he hears a voice who calls him Adam. Mm-hmm. Tell us, why is he Adam, and what sense is he Adam?
Well, yes, in the most immediate sense, of course, is Adam also was expelled, right? And this is key to how Adler saw the Shoah experience. He saw it as, of course, immediately and historically tragic for the individuals who suffer through it. But he also rises above it in a strange sense and sees it as a form of fate, as something that has been dealt to those individuals and a challenge for those individuals or himself or for Arthur to find a way through it, to rise above it, to maintain one's dignity, to maintain one's sense of self within it, rather than to simply blame the perpetrators. Adler, remember, was actively involved in blaming the perpetrators. He testified at the Auschwitz trials in Frankfurt. He supplied evidence to Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem. His scholarship is full of evidence against the perpetrators. So there's no simple or tidy forgiveness being forwarded here whatsoever. But he also knew that humanity had to move on, and that he had to move on, and that wrongdoing is inherent to human nature. Evildoing is inherent to human nature, as is good, as is the urge to survive, as is the urge to help. So it's a kind of biblical vision of the experience without being sort of strange about it. It's seeing Arthur as like Adam, someone who has been expelled from paradise and who must find his way in the world. Now, towards the end of the novel, he and Joanna think of themselves as Adam and Eve, literally, and that they have to plant a new garden of their own construction. And they'd have this discussion in South Wales, where they really realize their love for one another. In the same way, again, that Adler and his wife Bettina felt they had to move forward and make a life for themselves.
Now, this is the third book you've translated by Adler, and you are about to start a biography of him. Why have you become so obsessed by this man and his works?
Oh, boy. Immersed might be the better word, that you kind of can't even, it's hard to even see the forest for the trees anymore. I find him fascinating. I don't know another writer who does as such serious, ambitious work in both artistic fiction and serious scholarship. Secondly, he comes out of Prague. He comes out of the world of Kafka, out of the world of the Habsburg Empire, the first founding of Czechoslovakia. He enters Theresienstadt at the age of 32 with a doctorate, with a fully analytical mind. So this is not someone who just survived, but also observed while he was surviving. And then I can't help but be fascinated. He's also unknown. You know, he has terrible difficulty in publishing his novels and publishing his scholarship. Does manage to publish 26 books with rather marginal presses. And If you look in the literature, he is very much on the margins. If you look in the historical record, he's very much on the margins. So my real interest in writing the biography is to try to place him on the stage in his proper role and in his proper place.
Well, you've done amazing work of translation here, too. These are very long novels.
They are, yes. You know, I've been at this now about 13, 14 years. I love trying to write his sentences. What's interesting about him as a writer is he invents a new style for each novel. Panorama is basically a coming-of-age story. It's pretty straightforward. It's very realistic. The journey is very, almost like magical realism, is very fantastical, nightmarish in its construct, multi-voiced. The Wall is really a psychological novel. It's a novel of everyday life and the psychology of everyday life. So he's just, as a translator, he's just fascinating. You have to kind of keep reinventing your own style to keep up with him as a translator.
Well, Peter Thilkins, thank you so much for talking with us here about this fascinating writer, H.G. Adler.
Thank you, Francesca. It's always great to be here.
Peter Thilkins is a poet and translator of German literature. His translation of The Wall was named one of the best books of the year by Publishers Weekly. He teaches literature and writing at Bard College at Simon's Rock. You can go to writersvoice.net for our 2011 interview with Thilkins about the second novel in the trilogy, Panorama. After the break, we replay our 28th interview with him about H.G. Adler's first novel in the trilogy, The Journey. Stay with us. That was music from Overture for Small Orchestra by Hans Krause. He was a musician interned in Theresienstadt. He died there in 1944. And he is the composer of the famous children's opera, Brundibar. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first half of our show, we spoke with translator Peter Thilkins about H.G. Adler's novel, Panorama. Let's hear an interview with Thilkins in 2008 about the first novel in Adler's trilogy, The Journey, which Thilkins also translated. You discovered this novel, The Journey, by H.G. Adler in a Harvard Square bookstore.
That's right.
What were your thoughts when you came across the book?
Well, I was at Schoenhorst Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and looking through the German shelves for novels and pulled down this book, which had a beautiful cover on it, and read the first two pages and just knew I had to translate this book. It was the voice of the prose that spoke to me, a kind of lyrical, nightmarish, obsessive kind of quality to it in its urge to get its voice heard. And it just immediately jumped off the page at me, and I was off on my own journey. The book was first published in 1962, but it really disappeared. It had the support of people like Elias Canetti and Heinrich Böll. But despite their support and despite some very good reviews, the book just disappeared. It was published by a very tiny publishing house called Bibliotheca Christiana in Bonn. And it had been rejected for 12 years after Adler wrote it. He wrote it in 1950. And it wasn't published until 1962.
And in fact, its disappearance was in some ways not even accidental. There was a big publisher in Germany, Surkamp Verlag. The owner of that said that as long as he was alive, this book would never see print. Why this animosity towards this novel, The Journey?
Germany wasn't ready for novels about the Holocaust at the time. You have to remember that the Frankfurt trials on Auschwitz don't start occurring till 1964, 1965. And though there is some knowledge of the Holocaust at this time, there is not a real dealing with it in the country itself. But I think the other side of it is the lyrical quality of this novel. It's a very modernist novel. It's multi-voiced. I often describe it as, if you can imagine, Elie Wiesel's Night, written by Faulkner or Virginia Woolf. That's this novel. And the idea of writing such a stylistic, modernist work about such a nightmarish experience did not appeal at the time, particularly to someone like Theodor Adorno, the great thinker and cultural philosopher of the time, who said it was to write a poem after Auschwitz was barbaric. And he corresponded with Adler, and they disagreed on precisely this point. Adler felt you had to use every tool at hand to try to get at this experience, not only just history, not only just journalism, but also art and fiction and poetry.
You've really pointed to a kind of controversy around the Holocaust. Adorno was not the only one who has treated the idea of art about the Holocaust as a kind of a taboo, really, something that is beyond the pale. Explain that position. Why would art not be seen as seemly to describe the Holocaust?
Well, it's, I suppose, a kind of politics of art in some ways. If, you know, Adorno himself was a musical composer, and he stopped composing music after, I think it's 1949. He felt that in the face of such horror, in the face of such a national crisis, it was unseemly that art couldn't stand up to such experience, that either you end up sort of sanitizing or aestheticizing such an experience, or it just sort of becomes prettified. And of course, none of us wants that whatsoever. On the other hand, the imagination is a very powerful force. And to engage with this experience, particularly on a historical level, it requires the imagination, and more so as we move further away from this experience, because we are now at the time when that generation is dying, those who did survive. And all we are going to have left is a memory that is going to be constructed out of history, journalism, and art.
In fact, in reading this book, and I have to say I've read many, many Holocaust memoirs and accounts, this one, for the first time, I felt I got inside the head of somebody who experienced the Holocaust. So as you say, in some ways, the imagination created much more vivid a picture, this kind of surreal narrative. Tell us first about Adler's own experience of the Holocaust. First, just briefly, who was he, and then what did he experience?
He was born in 1910 in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and was educated there, grew up in an assimilated Jewish family, and went to the Charles University there, and that was in 1935. And his aspiration was to be a writer and a professor. And he considered himself of the Prague school of German writers, and the most famous one of that school is, of course, Franz Kafka. Unfortunately, history threw him a bad turn by 1938 or so, when things begin to happen in Germany. And it's in 1942 that he's deported to Theresienstadt, which is not a concentration camp, but a enforced slave community or ghetto, which the Nazis created it's often referred to as Hitler's gift to the Jews in this sardonic euphemism, because the deal that was offered was that in exchange for apartments and worldly goods, Jews were told that they could live in Theresienstadt and be taken care of for the rest of their lives. However, what happened is that 60,000 people ended up living in a 5-block radius, and you know, typhus and disease were rampant,
and very short rations.
Very short rations, very poor conditions. Adler lived in Theresienstadt for 2.5 years, along with his wife and her parents. Eventually, he was deported to Auschwitz and Buchenwald. His wife he lost in Auschwitz, and he survives the war and is liberated by the Americans in 1945, after which he returns to Prague. and in 1947 emigrates to London and begins to write his novels about this experience. He ends up writing 6 novels in his lifetime, 26 books overall. He never held an official position, an official teaching position. He lived in London as a freelance writer and tutor, sort of rubbing two sticks together to make ends meet, and somehow was able to do it and wrote in a white heat, particularly during the 50s. His best-known book at that time was a 1,000-page monograph on Theresienstadt itself. And it's very interesting. The day he set foot in Theresienstadt, he began to take notes and was determined to have a scholarly approach to this entire experience, and ended up with thousands of pages of notes, which he had to leave behind with Leo Beck, who was the leader of Germany's Jews, who was also in Theresienstadt. And Leo Beck, fortunately, was able to preserve these, because when Adler came back from Buchenwald, he met up with Leo Beck again. When he made his way back after the war, Leo Beck still had the notes, which would then go on to become Theresienstadt 1941 to 1945, which is his great monograph on the subject.
You say in your introduction to the book, and I'm talking with Peter Filkins, he's the translator of The Journey, a novel by H.G. Adler. It recounts the experience of a family,
yes,
that goes through a very similar experience as the one we're just talking about. You say in your introduction that this novel is as much about the soul and consciousness of the man who was possessed to write it as it is about the immediate suffering he endured himself. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are two levels of this novel. There's the content, the nightmarish content, obviously, the story of traveling to Theresienstadt, of surviving it, of going to a place like Auschwitz or Buchenwald and coming back from that as well. All of that is kind of there in the novel. None of these places are named. He creates fictional names for these places, and it follows a family called the Lustig family. And yet the novel is spoken from their perspective, from the guards' perspective, from the townspeople's perspective, from anonymous prisoners' perspective. It's multi-voiced, and sometimes you don't even know quite who's saying a certain sentence or speaking out loud. And that's very purposeful on his part. And how I think of that Adler's mind and imagination sort of surrounds all of those voices, or contains all of those voices. And if he's going to speak from his own consciousness and from sort of the inevitability of his consciousness, he has to speak through and of and by all of these voices. He has to use sort of every instrument in the orchestra, if you will, to make this work.
And it is a phenomenal voice and series of voices. The style of this novel is very striking. It is really original. I mean, we've already used the word surrealist. You called it a lyrical nightmare. Adler himself called it a tale, with a further subtitle of a ballad, which sounds like music. Mm. What was he getting at here first? And then I'll have you read this passage, a piece from the book.
Well, I think there's a kind of, in the sense of a tale, there's almost, and this again sounds very strange, but almost like a fairy tale. There's a kind of, as we say in German, a Märchen, a fairy tale-like quality to the novel, to passages of the novel. There are sort of separate little fairy tales about different scenes in the novel, different themes that come up. There's also a kind of mythic level. Adler knew that he was writing about Theresienstadt and the experience that he had, but he also knew that this wasn't the last time this experience was going to happen, and that this experience was not unique, and that while this is the experience of what we have come to term the Holocaust, it has shown up in other places, like, as we know, Rwanda or Srebrenica or Darfur. And this, unfortunately, is the 20th century story, a story of systems which displace people, both physically and in their spirit as well, which systems which cease to recognize human beings as human beings. And we've seen this happen in the Soviet Union and, you know, countless other places across the planet. And he's trying to write that tale, the tale that would speak to all of those atrocities that somehow he could see were going to happen again. Elias Canetti particularly praised the book in these terms, saying, "You have written the story of displacement that will speak to all displacements from here on out."
And so here on page 23 to 24, I mean, as you mentioned, the displacement of people who are not seen as people. And this is rather a long passage, but I think it really shows both the voice in which he speaks, as well as indicates the feeling that it is to experience this kind of displacement, this kind of rejection by society. So set us up first. Tell us what's going on here.
This is the place where the family and the other victims have been yanked out of their apartments in Stupart, which is the town that Adler uses, which, by the way, is the name of the street that Kafka grew up on. This is the way that he connects makes these little connections to the past and to the present history that, while it's a fictional name, it has some kind of irony to it. And they've been taken out of Stupart, and they are placed in something called the Technology Museum, which is, again, another kind of euphemistic way to think about this whole spirit, because if nothing else, the Holocaust is about the technology of death and how technology was used, you know, again, to alienate, displace, and ultimately kill human beings. And this is the part where they have left the Stupart and they're beginning their journey. They're beginning the long road of heading off towards Theresienstadt, which in the book is called Ruental.
And Ruental means peaceful valley.
Yes, again, another irony. All that had been forbidden in the world now meant nothing, for it had never been a law, but rather an arrangement that rested on enforced custom. What was once taken in stride now appeared all of a piece to the law, which had the last word and did not allow anything to contradict it. Life was reduced to force, and the natural consequence was fear, which was bound up with constant danger in order to rule life with terror. You experienced what you never had before. You rejoiced over that which you were allowed, but even this did not last for long, because any such comforts had only to be noticed, and the next day they were taken away. Thus, the tender, juicy meat was taken away, since you, who are made of flesh, need no meat. Then they banned fat, for your belly was full of fat. They denied you vegetables, for they stunk when they rotted. They ripped chocolate out of your hands, fruit and wine as well. You were told that there wasn't any more. Highways and byways were forbidden. The days were shortened and the nights lengthened, not to mention that the night was forbidden and the day forbidden as well. Shops were forbidden, doctors, hospitals, vehicles, and resting places forbidden, all forbidden. Laundries were forbidden, libraries were forbidden, music was forbidden, dancing forbidden, shoes forbidden, baths forbidden. And as long as there still was money, it was forbidden. What was and what could be were forbidden. It was announced, what you can buy is forbidden, and you can't buy anything. Since people could no longer buy anything, they wanted to sell what they had, for they hoped to eke out a living from what they made off their belongings. Yet they were told, what you can sell is forbidden, and you are forbidden to sell anything. Thus everything became sadder, and they mourned their very lives. But they didn't want to take their lives, because that was forbidden.
The sense of the walls closing in here, of the progressive disappearance of human beings, throughout this book, there is a sense of unreality. You know, this is unbelievable. In fact, he talks about much about belief and how that creates a world and how this world that he's in cannot be believed in, and yet it's happening. Talk about this interplay between reality and belief for Adler in this novel, The Journey.
Well, I think it's one of the most interesting aspects about the novel is, for Adler, he says, we need belief to go on in the world. And if you think about it, he's quite right. I mean, I need to believe that I can walk out the door and get into my car and go do the things that I'm able to do and expect that nothing essentially surprising is going to happen and that it's going to be there. On the other hand, to live in such a nightmare system, how do you maintain belief and how do you even expect that life can go on? It's always very important to remember that obviously the Holocaust was not something that was known while it was happening. Human beings were put in dire circumstances, but they didn't know the end game, if you will, while it was happening. They certainly could figure out that this was very bad, and as when the death machine really began to operate, they did know, and it must have been nightmarish. But at the same time, the characters in this book continue to believe that there's some way out, some way that they will survive, some way that they can take care of each other, particularly as a family, that as long as they stay together and as long as they live for another day, they have belief and hope that somehow they're going to get through it. Sadly enough, the bulk of the characters do not. Paul, the son, the Lustig son, is the one who survives and returns, and in some way is the voice narrating the entire novel as a kind of stand-in for Adler himself.
Adler writes of this character, Paul, that, quote, he often thought the connection we feel to our surroundings is frequently built on belief. And I'm just going to read another couple of sentences from that page because I think it really illustrates what we're talking about here. He says, when this belief is violated, then the connection is already dissolved and the consequences are incalculable. And then he goes on, he says, it doesn't matter whether or not such belief is true, if indeed it exists only as belief, for it preserves much more than its possible truth, namely the truth of belief in itself.
Yes.
And here I'm stepping out to comment on this. It's as if belief holds the world together, holds together reality. You know, a few years ago, I remember when I saw the movie Life is Beautiful, and people all around me were just loving that movie. Yeah. And talking about how it showed the resilience of the human spirit and all that. And I frankly thought it was, and I'll use a German word here, Dreck.
Yes.
Because I felt it trivialized the suffering. It wasn't real. So what makes this kind of belief that Adler talks about and that he expresses in this book, and in fact through his very aesthetic, through the beauty of his language, what makes that true and the other not?
Well, I think the complexity of the novel, the way that it asks of the reader to maintain a kind of belief through hallucinatory passages, through passages which lead us into a kind of, I would say, lyrical confusion, because the novel never really quite lets go of you. It never leaves you behind and leaves you lost for connections. As the editor said when he first read the selection from it, that he and his fellow editors at Random House said that they knew what was going on, though they didn't always know what was happening. And I think that's a perfect illustration, or at least a window into the experience of the victims themselves. If you can imagine living under such conditions, you probably do know what's going on, but you don't know exactly what is happening. And I think problems, what you're talking about, the kind of Dreckish versions of Holocaust novels or films, too easily convince us that we know what is happening and we know everything that is going on, and they provide a sort of very safe and tidy formula for this experience. Adler doesn't do that. And at the same time, he has, that's, I think that's the part of the lyrical nightmare. If you think about it, you know, a nightmare is where we are often confused and disoriented and don't know where we are and what's going on, but we're terrified at the same time. And lyricism is something that engages us, that lets us know that the rhythms of a poem or of a story are something that are familiar, that move us, that engage us, that make us want to go on, if you will, and find our way through the narrative and begin to order it and to shape it with our own imagination. Adler demands that of us. He doesn't let us be passive readers. We have to be active readers in engaging with this book.
Maybe you could read a passage that expresses that lyricism. And I was thinking about the passage that came just before the one you read, which reminds me in its personification of inanimate things, of that kind of lyricism.
Sure. The streets were quiet, heartened by the winter cold. The impact of the heavy steps pleased them, for that stamped life into them. Otherwise, the streets would have been sunk in sadness. They were forbidden streets, meant to be avoided in order not to violate their pavement. Thus, the streets were crossed out on the maps, no longer existing for anyone. It was too risky. Danger lay in wait there, especially at night. But one must not simply accept what is forbidden once you are not worth anything. And so the streets were there again, and were much longer and more beautiful than they had ever been before. They rejoiced at being granted life once again, and didn't ask to whom they owed their good fortune. Zerlina said earnestly to an intruder, "These streets are forbidden." But the stranger just smirked and rubbed his hands, because those words, so often repeated, no longer meant anything, for now the forbidden was allowed.
Yeah, and the streets rejoicing. You know, these are, after all, streets that Zerlina, who is Lustig's daughter, that they're going down as they go towards this technology museum prior to their deportation.
Yeah. Well, I think the role of the inanimate in the novel, that one of the central motifs is rubbish, because the Leo Lustig at Theresienstadt, like Adler, worked on the garbage detail. And the garbage wagons there were former funeral wagons, which they used to put the garbage onto and haul it out of town. And Adler very much plays upon this in saying that this is what's going to remain, that no matter how much atrocity goes on, there will be a residue of it, that garbage will be the residue left over, and that the axe cannot be hidden forever, which again is another form of belief. So that if inanimate objects can still have a life and a history to them, then there's still hope that the animate objects, if you will, in other words, human beings, will carry on as well.
Well, it's a masterful novel, The Journey by H.G. Adler, and a masterful translation.
Thank you.
By my guest, Peter Filkins. Thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Peter Filkins, talking about The Journey, the first in a semi-autobiographical trilogy by H.G. Adler, who died in 1988. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.